Ladies and gentlemen, at this point in the evening, we want to feature one of the finest percussionists that Led Zeppelin's ever had. The bowler-hatted wonder. The man who made constipation passé. John Bonham, Moby Dick.
Well, good evening. This is Mark McFall. You are listening to the Zep Fan Podcast. This will be episode 14. We're just cruising along. Season 2, I think we're in. How cool is that? Anyway, thanks everyone for listening. Thanks for enjoying the Led Zeppelin chat. I enjoy doing it. Hopefully you enjoy listening to it. If you have any questions for me, you could reach out to me at contact@zepfan.com. Look forward to your email. Let's dive right into it. Here we go. Our guest today has played an essential part of keeping us Zep fans together in the 1990s. Not only did he provide us with the self-published fanzine, The Only One, but he has also been responsible for doing 8 Led Zeppelin conventions, which obviously is an incredible accomplishment. That, my friends, is the one and only Grant Burgess from Canada. Grant is here and will talk some Zep with us, sharing his stories of publishing the fanzine and, of course, promoting these conventions. Grant, welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Mark. It's been great talking to you. Probably been 20 years since we talked last.
I think that's the intro of all my podcasts. It's like, yeah, we haven't talked in 20 years. But it's great to go back to people who are still into it, right? Because it still enjoys the love of Zeppelin and it never really leaves you. For those who may not be familiar with you, can you tell us who you are, where you're at, and what you do?
Well, I mean, I got into Led Zeppelin collecting probably in the late 80s, early 90s. And what had happened was I started doing the swapping stuff in the mail, just like you did. You may have started around the same time as me. And then I built up a network of fans. And eventually, by the time 1994 rolled around in the spring, I could see where other fanzines have kind of closed their doors for one reason or another. They just kind of worked their cycle and just decided to gracefully shut the doors, and I thought, I'll give it a try.
Right.
And then of course, you know, I picked a really weird name, The Only One, and it's a joke on a couple of levels.
Yeah.
It's actually a joke, because back around 93, you know, Robert was even said in an interview, are you ever going to record any more songs with Jimmy? And he goes, back in 88 on the Outrider album, I did a song called The Only One, and that's the only one he's going to get.
Right, exactly.
And then I figured, you know what? If they get back together, great. If they don't get back together, well, then that's the only song they did since Zeppelin.
Right, and that was a pretty darn good song, too, I thought.
And, you know, it was really funny how that all materialized, because what had happened was, oh, God, around 93 when Robert was touring in the fall, there was a gentleman with me that hung out with the shows, and he liked recording to him, and we met up at the Syracuse plant show from the Fate of Nations tour. And
nice.
I was a little outspoken with my opinions, and he wanted to buy tickets from a scalper. And I just said to him, you know what I do? I buy my tickets the day of the show, the week of the show. They're going to release some good tickets at the office. So the guy listens to my advice, gets a really good seat at the show, and he gets ready to set up his tape recording equipment and that. And then he looks behind him. There's Jimmy Page.
Oh, wow.
And that was in Boston where they met and started discussing the infancy of the Page Plant project.
Right. And I also have you seen the pictures Michael Wolff have taken of Plant and Page walking the streets of Boston? That's pretty remarkable too, from 93.
Yeah.
That, you know, back then, not having internet or any of that stuff, you know, hearing those rumors and actually seeing them walking together, that was a big deal. So those are some pretty amazing photos.
So that was kind of something there interesting, that it all started then. And then I guess what happened was, then moving forward to 94, I just started publishing my first issue. And then I went over to England and actually did the convention that was put on by Dave Lewis and Andy Adams.
Right.
And then I kind of looked at that and I go, it's great what they did there. It was a great time and everything. And then from then on, I thought, there's nothing like that in North America going on. And one thing led to another. And within the next couple of years, I had actually thought, maybe I could give it a try.
Right,
but
convention.
In the meantime, I started publishing the issues. And I think you were kind of in the process of getting a fanzine together around that time, too.
Right. I think I started in 95, if I'm not mistaken.
And then after I got a couple of issues out, I got a phone call from their management company, because I always took the approach, you know what, they can do whatever they want, the lawyers and all that. And I just thought, let them know what's going on. So I decided to, you know, start sending issues of the fanzine to the management company. And then one day in early August of 94, I get a phone call from their management company and they go, those rumors you've been hearing about Page and Plant are true. They are going to get back together. And we'd like you to fly in and come to the tapings of the Unleaded show.
Yes, I forgot you were at those. That's so amazing.
And, you know, it was interesting because it was like, you know, being there to see them in stage together in front of maybe 250 people there. Dave Lewis would probably have a better head count than that because he seems to know more about that. You know, whereas I'm just this guy that flew in from Canada and thought it was great. I just kind of like sat back in the middle of the room about seven rows back.
Just taking it all in too.
And, you know, it was kind of, you know, definitely an interesting experience because that was when it all started to come together. The whole
Page Plant
situation
project, yeah.
With Page Plant and the whole rebirth. And it was definitely something that you remember seeing. And it was pretty much what you saw in the video was pretty representative of the show that was there.
I remember watching that like crazy when it aired on MTV, but if you just think how much they progressed throughout that whole tour and how much, you know, they started improvising more and just how much they started engaging in each other was just really phenomenal. Because now if you go back and listen Unleaded, it's not bad, but it's so much better if you look, you know, end of the tour in Madison Square Garden or something like that.
I mean, the whole thing with that tour, I thought was, it was not a Led Zeppelin tour on different levels. First of all, they didn't have all the mistakes that were associated with Led Zeppelin shows.
Right.
I mean,
right.
You know, to me, Led Zeppelin were a band on stage that they would be like your football, baseball, hockey team, where they'd make some brilliant moves and then they'd do some not so brilliant.
They pushed it every night for sure.
And with the Unleaded, it was, you know, it was definitely more polished than the Zeppelin. The other thing right. That was very interesting, especially in the 95 show, was they did a lot of shows that, or a lot of material that was not performed in the Zeppelin shows.
Right.
So that was something there that was unique. And then a couple of songs like Kashmir, for example, that's one stuck out where I think they did it better on that tour than they did in the Zeppelin tours. And then, of course, the best Kashmir, some people will say, was at the O2 show.
I was at the O2 show, and I'll never forget that feeling I had because I was listening to the, you know, the end of the Kashmir when it's just going crazy, and you hear Bonham and the drums and stuff. And I remember being there, and it just, I went into a different level. I mean, I just totally zoned out. I'm like, whoa. And it brought me back in. I'm like, this is intense. And it just, my first thought was like how Zeppelin would have done it in the 75, 77, and how intense that would have been too. But it just like pulled me in. And there's nothing like live music anyway. And just hearing it that loud, it was pretty intense. But I agree with you. I mean, the Page Plant shows were really good. I know a lot of people were upset that Jones wasn't there. And, you know, that's a totally different conversation altogether. But they were good shows. I mean, while they said they weren't Led Zeppelin shows, after the first leg, they kind of dove into just Led Zeppelin songs.
Yeah, and it was almost ironic for me because in North America, I think, you know, so what I saw in 94 was of course, their performance in front of a very small audience. And then in the 95 North America, I think their biggest crowd was 30,000 people at the Sky Dome in Toronto. So it's like I got to see them in a very small audience and then the biggest audience on the tour.
Right. Very cool.
So that was like two different in settings right there, one extreme to the other. And ironically, Toronto, I ended up in the front row.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. I know I was front row at the Shoreline 1995 show for the Greenpeace and a few other shows as well.
Yeah.
But
and, you know, you just kind of, you went through that. And, and of course, covering the first tour, that made it interesting. And then as the tour came to the end, and that's probably how I started flowing into the convention. Because if you think about it, I kind of like started planning it in about May of 96, actually. Mm-hmm. And it would take about 6 months to start to finish to actually plan the convention. Because and even before I went down and made the deposit, met with the people, you know, you might remember I probably spent about a month going, do you think I can make this happen?
Right. Well, the first one was a really good time. I mean, I remember the Cleveland 95 because it was I mean, that was really cool because it was right when Digital Graffiti, I think that was the name of the mailing list. Yeah, it was coming out and all these people, you know, finally, you know, you're corresponding through email this whole time and basically having pen pals and everybody got together. So it was just so cool that everyone could finally meet and put faces to the names and, you know, just sit around talking Led Zeppelin to everybody. It was a really great event.
Yeah. And I mean, the first couple of times are always the most special. And, you know, it was kind of interesting getting all that together. Because I'm an accountant by nature and education, I managed to do all that without, you know, and covering costs of every event. And that was one thing that, you know, seemed to be a challenge in the other people that may have done the events in the past, is that it just was very difficult to finance. You'd be taking a lot of risk and potentially risking a lot of money.
Right. And I don't think, I mean, other than, like you mentioned earlier, there was the New Jersey convention that Brian Knapp did. There was no other U.S. conventions. So that was it. You're responsible for the only one. Ah, look at that. Segue into the fanzine.
Yeah. And, you know, it was, so, I mean, when we got into that, that was kind of interesting. And then how I targeted Cleveland was I actually used a club that was involved in the concert promotion business, because then it actually gave me some local access to the media, like for free promotion, right, because they would promote the events at the show. Because, so, I mean, what you had was someone that had a good working relationship with the concert promoters and then with the local media, so that you would not come across as some guy that is an unknown in the area, because that can make it quite challenging to try to self-promote your own show there.
Right.
And that worked out really good because it gave the credibility. And then what happened was, of course, when I'm doing the first convention, I kind of had to make that phone call to the management company of the band to let them know what I was doing, because they would have heard about it. And it's just the type of thing, I took the approach, it's better to tell them in advance. Right. So, and it worked out really well, because when I had that phone call to the representative in London, I said, you know what? She just said, basically, there's three things. One, the band won't appear there. And I go, I never said they would.
Yeah.
And number two, don't ask us for any money or anything. And number three, don't do anything illegal. And
right.
I go, I can assure you that you got your hands on if there's anything, any hanky-panky going on. And I go, here's why. The people that owned that club, the Odeon, that was owned by the concert promoters in Cleveland, who actually promoted the Page Plant shows.
Honey from Trinifold, I remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've talked to her a few times as well.
And then, of course, the security company they hired was actually run by Hall Security. It was run by Jim Singleton. So it had this tie-in where, you know, I could just basically say, yeah, if you think there's anything going on, you guys got your information pipeline like you wouldn't.
Right.
Because y'all, I think when you had Dave on last time, he alluded that, you know, there were people in paying attention to what he was doing with it when he ran Zoso magazine.
Right.
And I mean, that way it was there above board. And so that one went off. And then, of course, you might remember that weekend, there was a freak snowstorm that hit one city in North America, Cleveland.
That, I actually don't remember, to be honest. I think we were indoors the whole time drinking.
Yeah. And I mean, it was like a freak snowstorm. And then there must have been a foot of snow or something. It was like the only place in North America, and we got hit with a blizzard.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's kind of like where it all started.
You touched on a lot of things that you've done, and I'm very happy about that. And then I have, you know, I want to dive a little bit deeper into pretty much everything you talked about. So, you know, for those that don't know Grant, now you do. There's his backstory, and we're going to dive a little bit deeper into everything. When did you start collecting? At what age and what year?
It probably would have been about them. You know what? It's kind of funny, but I mean, when I was in high school, I actually found this store in Hamilton that sold live recordings and on the albums. And it was really interesting because there's another story that, goes a little bit off topic, but it was kind of funny. But I remember actually buying Mudslide from that store.
Oh, very cool.
And it was just something there. And so it was like late 70s I got into buying some of those vinyl albums.
You got into Zeppelin. Cool.
And, you know, back then, it's kind of interesting because being from the Toronto area, the big band that came out of our area was Rush, of course.
Right, of course, yeah.
And When Rush's All the World the Stage came out, it actually came out about 2 or 3 weeks before the song Remains the Same, like the album. And actually, I probably played that one a lot more than the song Remains the Same.
It's not a bad album to play.
Big Rush fan. And then, of course, to top it off, within 2 months, like, I went to my first concert where Rush were playing at a small theater in Hamilton with about 3,500 people.
Oh, wow.
And that was almost identical to the All the World's a Stage album show. And the next night is when Rush became a headline arena act in Toronto. That was their very first. So they graduated from playing these mid-sized venues to playing headline arena shows in Toronto. So it was kind of like a very interesting time period.
Yeah, and definitely. That's not a bad time.
Yeah, and then, of course, we saw the song Remains the Same. I didn't probably see that till about, I'd say, at least 78, maybe even early 79.
So what was it that, you know, why Led Zeppelin? I mean, what was it about this band that intrigued you so much to dive deeper into them, you know, collecting tapes, eventually doing a fanzine, want to do a publication? What was it about the band that was different than Rush or some other bands that you were into?
Well, I think what happened with Zeppelin is I started getting into collecting all that stuff. But then what you and I probably can relate to is that prior to the internet breaking out, we were collecting a lot of things and building
off.
Up these pen pal relationships from people all over the continent and in many cases all over the world. And we built up these relationships and it was kind of like a second family to us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what happened was I saw that, you know, I made some very good special friendships with people. And it just kind of evolved, and I go, and that's what probably put me over the edge where I go, I think I can start a fan publication. I think I can start doing Led Zeppelin conventions.
Yeah, nice.
And I mean, it probably just evolved from that because there was those relationships that we built up that you just kind of felt, this is great.
Yeah. Did you, you collected tapes a lot, live stuff?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And I mean, yeah, it was tracking down the lower generations and, you know, people would come in, you know, stuff would come in from all over the place. We definitely crossed paths with a lot of the same people, I would say.
Right. Yep. And you're always getting turned on to somebody else. Like, oh, this person has this. And my biggest thing, because I was focused more on video than audio, when I, you know, you got a tape, just like audio, you'd like, okay, where did you get this tape from? How can I get a better generation? And you kept tracking down where it came from. So that was, you're always on the hunt. And I still am. I mean, even when I get something, I still ask, is there a better version of it?
Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it was more challenging because you didn't have the digital technology. I mean, I think what happens is probably with all that stuff is it really depends on how well connected these people are, because they're the people that... not everyone that tapes a show or whatever back then lets out their copies for one reason or another. It might not. Sometimes it's their choice. Sometimes it's a case of they don't know that they have is valuable.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, you've run into that too. And sometimes, like, there's all kinds of reasons. And I mean, I don't want to do a, you know, study the psychology of it, but sometimes people don't know enough, or sometimes people forget about it.
Yeah, I would have to agree with you. And, you know, back then too, there was a lot more, I think, value in high trade value too. So when you knew you had something rare, you'd hold on to it and maybe trade for something as rare for it. So that's why a lot of people didn't want to tell people, because, you know, they're, you know, you get more contacts and, you know, you don't want to trade it out for that reason too.
Well, I mean, there's, and I mean, we could get into a whole discussion on that, and, you know, I just don't, you know, that could be another whole.
Right, exactly.
I mean, you could write a book on that.
During your collecting years, what are you most proud of finding? Is there anything that you unearthed that you brought to the Zeppelin public?
I mean, to be very blunt, you know, I've found some tapers, but I mean, they were through introductions. I mean, nothing really that I can say, you know, that I had that no one else found.
Hmm.
I mean, it's just, you know, maybe I shared it a little more openly. I mean,
right, exactly. Yeah, that could be the case too, because that happened quite a bit too.
And, you know, so I mean, that's what you got to look at is,
you know, I miss the hunt too, because it's just kind of same thing. If you buy a memorabilia, if you hunt stuff down, it's always about the hunt. And I think that's what I missed most, because tape trading isn't really, or video trading, trades really don't exist anymore. You know, it's more of, you know, if someone gets something, they just release it, or they just don't tell you about it.
Yeah.
So it's not, there's not a trading circle anymore. You mentioned, let's go to the fanzine now. So you started that in 1994. Talked a little bit about your drive, why you started it. You know, what's your favorite memories from that? Is there any favorite articles that you recall that you did on?
You know what? That was so long ago. And I think what happened was it seemed like a great idea at the time. And, you know, and of course what it did was, I think the whole thing was it spearheaded things like the convention, and that's, it evolved into that. I mean, obviously it was great getting people like Frank Malfi donating his photos to the, you know, from day one, having that key contact. He was great using his stuff. That was something very valuable. I mean, sometimes you just look at it and you go, you write about your passions, and then sometimes what it really was it was an item where people would communicate back and forth with me. And that's what I really thrived on.
And just
more
a way of meeting more people too. And from my standpoint of doing a fanzine. I mean, I enjoyed the pen pals, and you know, I wrote stories for it, but I'm definitely not a writer. And I look back at some of those stories, I'm like, oh, I just went for it.
I know, and that's the thing. It's like sometimes what you remember is all, and you remember the people that were very supportive of you, a lot of the kind words and kind compliments you get. Right. Sometimes you can remember that more than what you actually put down.
Right. It's a lot of work. Yeah.
You know, and that's what I really liked.
Right. How many issues did you do?
I think I got up to about 16.
Oh, yeah, that's not bad. That was bi-monthly or is it quarterly?
Yeah, bi-monthly.
Okay, yeah, very cool. I have most of your fanzines on my website. I still need a few, so I don't know if we could talk later.
We'll work that out.
Yeah, I would love to get the rest of them up on the website just so people could see them. It's pretty interesting because I'm a big fan of fanzines too. And on my website, I think I have well over 400 of them. It's amazing how many came out of the woodwork that I didn't even know about from all over the country or all over the world. I mean, and it's just really cool to see a fan's devotion to doing something for the band. So, yeah, I'd love to get those on there so other fans could see them.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's always good. And, you know, and I know you've really gotten your passion back since you've put that website together. I haven't had time to explore it in Dopamine.
Yeah.
But from what I'm hearing, it's like a labor of love for you.
You know, it's one of those things that you always have a passion for it. Zeppelin's always in my veins. So I'll stop doing something and then, but somehow I get pulled back into it. Whether it be, I've always wanted to do a book, like a big coffee style book on memorabilia. And then doing the website, zeppfan.com, is a much better solution than doing a book because I could always update it, fix the mistakes, you know, and that's kind of the times too. People would rather go on a website, I think, than read a book because the book could just get thrown in the closet.
And I mean, we're going to probably look at ourselves and go, how many books do we have that...
how many have you actually read?
...and through, but we haven't read them.
Right. So I remember your convention. So you mentioned 8 conventions. So I remember 4 of them. So let's talk about all of them and just you could fill us in some of the details on it. But we have Cleveland 1996, Niagara...
Yep, I think we touched on a lot of that one.
Yep, Niagara 1997...
Yep, and that one, yeah, 97, that was an unusual one because, like, Cleveland, that was based on working with a promoter in a club. And 97, if you remember, we saw, that was like a self-promoted type of event.
Right.
Where we didn't have a radio station really backing us or anything like that, but it was more a localized event. We got some local publicity, but it was... basically all at the Falls View Inn Hotel, if you remember.
What I remember about the Niagara was hanging out with Dardo. I remember meeting Alberto from Italy the first time and eating hot wings with him and just a lot of partying on that one. So good time.
Yeah, and I mean, everything was all contained at the hotel.
Yeah.
And,
Which is nice, too.
It's all and, you know, like it was a different... structure where in Cleveland it was a hotel and a club that we dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and of course Michael White played there again, and that was kind of funny. I remember him, you know, I paid him in cash, but I didn't want him to lose the cash, so what I did was I went to the hotel manager and I said, can I borrow a safety deposit box? So I gave Michael White his fee in cash, but it was in the hotel safety deposit box. And of course, he had to run and grab the cash because he had, you know, obviously seen the song or made.
Right, there you go. And it just, if all things happen Zeppelin-wise, we don't know what's going to happen to that safe deposit box.
I mean, it was kind of because I just got, like, I didn't even think of that, but I guess to him, he thought that was about the funniest thing that, you know... that, you know, funny gag on him.
Right.
But, you know, and I go, hey, what about my money? I go, here's your hotel safety deposit box key.
Right. There. You know, one of the other memories I have, I actually was able to get from Much Music, remember they had those, the Nebor stand-ups. I don't know if you remember those. And I was able to get them. Barrett ended up with them, and I ended up trading for Barrett because I was huge into displays back then. I was able to get those from Barrett. And I remember the guy from, I'm assuming Toronto or Canada, sent them to me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had to go pick them up at the airport because it wasn't sent normal post. It was delivered to a place by the airport that I had to go pick them up. So it was definitely cool. So
it was funny. Jeff would have been the guy that had the Zeppelin photos from Toronto in 69.
Oh, yeah. I remember those too. Yeah.
And, you know, it was interesting because I actually ran into him before I was doing the conventions. There was a local event going on, like a outdoor festival in Hamilton. It was called the Festival of Friends. And, you know, I'm just walking through a local park and, you know, there's a music event going on. And with just a bunch of Canadian bands playing, no one major, but, and all of a sudden I see this guy selling pictures of Led Zeppelin when they played in Toronto in 69. And that's how I found the guy.
Wow. Yeah. Those are stunning photos.
And then what happened was within a few months, you know, you know, he goes, nobody's really talked to me about these pictures or anything. And then within a few months, I introduced him to Luis Rey's publisher, Bob Walker. And that's how it made the cover of the book, one of Luis, I think of the second edition of the Life Tape book. So, I mean, that's how that all evolved there. And then it was just one of those things that just by a fluke, that's how I found something.
Nice. Yeah, those photos were stunning. The Cleveland 1998 conventions were cool because you wrapped that around a Page Plant show. So that was a great approach to promoting a convention. How did that come about?
Well, that was because I had some success with them in the first convention. Remember, I was dealing with people that promoted the Page Plant 95 shows. And if my memory's right, I think Belkin Productions back then were even promoting Zeppelin shows in Cleveland. So what had happened was that because I had a working relationship, I go, would it be possible if we tied in another convention, but could I buy a block of tickets for the concert?
Nice.
For the
people? Of course.
And of course, they're in promoting the shows. And of course, the first time Page Plant was around, it was a guaranteed sellout. But sometimes the second time around, you're going, we might need help selling out the shows. Yeah. Because the initial buzz is over. So obviously they just thought that would be great because then it co-promotes two events. And so that was how that deal more or less went around. I originally started with about a block at 200 tickets and then it gradually increased to 250 tickets. Then it went up to 350 tickets. The only thing that was a little hard and frustrating with that is we did get a little emotional, and out of the 350 allocation, it's not like they were terrible seats. They're all in the best third of the building, but
right.
Some people got better seats than others, and that's unfortunate. And, you know, some people would prefer paying the higher dump. Say ticket brokers and getting tickets in the first five rows.
Yeah.
I mean, there's obviously those things where it's hard to really make everybody happy, but we did pull it off and we had about 350 people there and that got the tickets from me. And of course the attendance at the convention was huge as well, because not only the people with the tickets, but a lot of people locally that got tickets through their own resources. And then what I kind of did, and I don't know how much of it you stayed on, did you come in for the Pittsburgh show as well?
No, I didn't. And as you were telling the story, that's one of the things I do recall, because the tickets or the concerts kind of all aligned around Pittsburgh, the two nights in Detroit as well. So you could actually make a week trip and just see a bunch of Page Plant shows.
I know. And it was like, so what we did was the night, you know, before the convention started in Cleveland, I ran a bus trip, and then I got a decent rate at actually the Comfort Inn Hotel in Cleveland, and we ran a bus from Cleveland to Pittsburgh. So if you came in the extra day, like I had a busload of people going from there as well. I think that was like July 1st, the Pittsburgh show. And so we did a bus trip from the Comfort Inn in Cleveland to the Pittsburgh show. Everyone came back the same night. And so that's what we did. And the funny thing is that Comfort Inn in Cleveland, in the 1970s, it was actually known as a hotel called Swingo's, which is where Led Zeppelin stayed at when they came to Cleveland.
How ironic is that?
And, you know, that whole week was, you know, plus a few of us took in the three Michigan shows prior to that, which included Grand Rapids and the two nights in Auburn Hills for the Detroit market. Yeah. And I think I had the incidents take place in Grand Rapids. You might have heard about those stories.
No, what happened?
What had happened was in Grand Rapids, first of all, on that Sunday, I kept running into the earlier shows. I kept running into Lily Hayden's band everywhere we went. Like, they seemed to be staying.
She was the opening band, yeah.
Yeah, we kept running into them because they're staying at the same hotels with me because I didn't have the budget for the Page Plant.
You don't have the Page Plant money, you got the Support Act money.
Yeah, so I mean, I kept running into them. So that Sunday, I remember, we actually, that Sunday afternoon, I was driving around in Grand Rapids, the bass player, I believe it was, and Lily Hayden for a couple hours, just for an hour or two. So that was kind of different. And then Sunday night, you know, we go to the bar at the Amway Grand Hotel, which was across from where I was staying, and it's close to the venue. And there's Robert hanging there in the bar for about 3 hours.
Oh, very cool.
Right till closing time.
Yep.
So, I mean, we were hanging out there, a bunch of us. And, you know, which is definitely makes it an interesting day. And then the next day, the day of the Grand Rapids show, and that's the show that, you know, a little bit of excitement broke loose, you might say. First of all, we go to lunch at a restaurant called TGI Fridays. I'm not sure if they have them in California.
Right, they
or
do
not, but, okay. And just as I'm sitting down, getting ready to leave lunch, Jimmy's walking out of the restaurant.
Oh, cool.
Missed him by that much, as Maxwell Smart would say.
Right, right.
And then, of course, we go to the show. And after the show, I run into their tour manager in a bar. I think it was called Flanagan's. And of course, his job, there's maybe 20 people in the job in the bar, but his job was to, you know, keep everyone away from Jimmy. And I introduce myself, not because I'm hearing about, you know, not because I want to drool all over Jimmy or anything like
right,
that.
Right.
I had some information to share with them, and I have a chat with the gentleman, and I introduce myself, and he goes, yeah, I know who you are. Okay, good. I got something to tell you. And I go, we're doing a Led Zeppelin convention in Cleveland in a few days. And he goes, so what? And I go, well, we got 350 people coming in from all over the world for this event. I just thought you might want to know that. And he goes, so what? And I go, we're all staying at the Renaissance Inn. All of a sudden, you just
red
hear
flag.
Everybody in the whole bar hears him go, Jesus Christ, that's where we're staying. And sure enough, you know, they had to make some arrangements, you know, and you just saw the guy flipping around, making call after call on his cell phone, and I see his arms flying all over the place while he's calling people, and he's pointing at me and going, he's got 350 people coming in for a convention. And then, of course, he's trying to tell me that the band for the Cleveland show decided to stay in Chicago for a couple of days.
Right.
And so that was the incident you may have heard about, that the band was supposedly booked to stay at the Renaissance, where we were staying. And that was one of those things that, you know, some people for years were debating, should I have told the road manager or not about that?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you looked at that and you kind of go, that's a tough one to call. But I think what I looked at when I did that, Mark, was, you know, the year was 1988. It was about July, pretty well. And less than a year earlier, there was like 20 people with cameras that got Princess Diana killed, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, I just look at it and I go, the last thing I'd want to have to do is live with is have some disaster happen because Robert and Jimmy can't get their privacy after a show.
Right.
I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think anything like that would have happened, but you always go something, it could get a little crazy. And those guys are there to do a job. They're there to do a show and they're not them do their show, you know?
So that sums up Cleveland 1996, Niagara 1997, Cleveland 1998. Now, that's three conventions. There's five more. Were they all done in Canada? There's a Toronto 1998
as well. Well, actually, what had happened was I'd used, I believe it was called the Diamond Club in 1999 in Toronto. And that one, you know, we had about 300 people, but it was all local pretty much. And then what happened was it was just kind of a localized event. The thing that was different with Toronto was we had a different sort of vendors. And I think what had happened was you guys probably ran out of stuff to sell probably after the first three conventions.
That was an interesting time too, because that's when eBay started taking over. So you know, a lot of people started buying everything from eBay as well. So I don't know if you heard the podcast I did with Rick Barrett and him talking.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And, you know, Rick, obviously, I think what brought him to do the 2000 one was because it was tied in with a Jimmy Black Crowes show. But, I mean, I think the thing with Toronto was we tried it. And I remember talking to Rick about the one in Toronto in 99. I think he just wanted to pass on it for a bit because, you know, I think eBay was starting to come in and...
Right, because it's not cheap.
And then, of course, you see how much stuff he would bring, trying to haul it over the border and back.
Right, and he would go, to the local hardware store, Home Depot, and then, you know, buy a bunch of stuff to set up his booth. So, you know, he invested quite a bit. So if you're not coming out with, you know, $15,000, $20,000, probably I would assume it's not really financially
worth
it.
And then you have to look at it that... in Canada with the exchange rate,
right?
You know, I mean, I think I didn't even really, I think I just wanted a local vendor crowd because, it was more about the idea you want that because you don't want all the costs involved and you don't want vendors losing their shirts,
right?
Things like that.
Cause you need a big turnout to make the money because, you know, you need those.
Well, I mean, but the problem is in Canada, like with the exchange rate, yeah, you might think I'll mark up my prices accordingly, but then you're stuck with a lot of unsold merchandise. And, of course, you know, the following year we went back to Cleveland. We had tickets allocated if we could sell them for the Page Crowes show, but if, as you know, that whole thing got canceled. Yep. So, I mean, that one, you know, it was a little disappointing. I mean, the people that showed up still made the best of it, had a nice time. But, I mean, it was, you know, it was a difficult one because it really, you know, just you just kind of go.
Right.
Everyone was disappointed from Jimmy canceling the tour and all that.
Yeah. I mentioned earlier, like, my bucket list of doing... you know, a book and stuff. One of my bucket lists is always to do a convention, but I don't know these times if it would even be sustainable to do a Led Zeppelin convention because I don't know how many people would actually come out. So we talked earlier, I think off air, about another, there was supposed to be another convention, I think in Maryland, right? Or Virginia. And that never went through. So I just don't even know if it's feasible nowadays to attempt to do a convention if people would actually come out. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, here's the problem that one, I think the issue was, I don't think he understood the scale of the Zeppfest, that he thought he could do something that had a budget of 15,000 to 20,000 people. That would be, from what I could see, his break-even budget.
Right.
Because he had, I don't know, 3 days of bands or something, and I'm like going... he didn't have a budget that was realistic, and he just kind of called me once, and I'm not going to criticize him, but I think he made some fundamental errors where I think the scale was way too big, because I even looked at, for example, you know, a lot of the things I wish I could have done, but it didn't make economic sense, was the idea of guest speakers.
Right.
Because back in those days, let's say it cost $1,000 for a guest speaker. By the time, let's say someone said, I'll fly over, you pay for my airplane ticket and my hotel. Let's say it's $1,000. But I mean, if we're charging $12 a ticket, that means that that person has to draw $80 roughly, 80 tickets sold because of his name, mm-hmm. incrementally, to make that $1,000 pay for itself. That is where there's a bit of a problem.
So do you think it's possible to do a convention now?
I think it would be very difficult because our culture has kind of changed. First of all, a lot of us kind of have gotten to the stage where we got more important things to going on in our life than taking half a week off to fly across the country and meet with people.
Right.
I mean, that's very difficult, the time commitment. And then you also have to look at your responsibilities, that you have going on with your life. It might be that much more difficult than it was 20 years ago. And the other thing that made it worthwhile for the vendors at the convention, without the vendors, you basically don't have a lot, because it boils down to a tribute show. Without the vendors, what they need to make it work for them is fresh new product. Because you need something to offer to justify your trip in selling merchandise, because you probably might have looked at it and go, I need to sell these X number of dollars to cover my flight and my hotel. If I do that, I'm okay. But when there's no new product coming out, that is a big challenge too. Because when there was for example, Rick would deal with memorabilia and stuff like that. There really hasn't been any new products that would offer Led Zeppelin memorabilia these days.
Yeah.
And, I look at that, and then, Rick had a very good point about the eBay, where, it forced him to change his whole approach to doing business. And, that's where I can definitely see his word, because that was what he thrived on, and yeah. He obviously felt it a lot more than you or I would have. So you have the eBay. You also have a lack of new product, and then you wonder, is the interest level even there?
Yeah, exactly.
And then the other events that kind of took place, we did... What had happened was, what you also missed out on was, there was actually four more conventions. Because we stopped doing them in 2000, as you remember. Then in early 2003, I actually did a smaller one in Toronto at Jeff Healey's club. You might have heard of Jeff Healey, the guitarist.
Yeah. Of course. Of course.
So he ran a club in Toronto, and we actually put something together with him. And, and then there was a lady that was involved with the Action for Brazil charity, Cindy. And then she actually got some autograph stuff from Jimmy that was signed, and then it was being sold to raise money for Jimmy's charity, the Action for Brazilian Children.
Yeah.
So we tied it in with that, just kind of scaled it down a bit, because again, with the Toronto, it's the vendors, and I think Rick was pretty we didn't have the big vendors like we had before, but there were more localized things going on, and then of course money was being raised for the charity. What was interesting about these ones was the first one, we did it at Jeff's club, and the tribute band was a different band we used called Zeppelin-esque, and actually Jeff came out and played four songs with the band.
Oh, cool.
So that was something unique that happened in 2003, but The one thing that was a little bit of a disaster on that one, I seem to get followed with disasters, interesting thing, but that took place in the spring of 2003, and that's when the SARS crisis hit Toronto.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounded familiar.
Middle of the SARS crisis.
Yeah.
So to make up for that one, about 6 months later, we went back to another hotel in Niagara Falls, New York, and then did another localized event there. And, you know, it had maybe 100, 200 people there. But actually, people really liked it there. It was a small, intimate crowd, but they had a great time. And it was a case of, you know, just everything was all contained in the hotel like the first time. But, you know, it was a different hotel. And the hotel was an older hotel, but it didn't have all the problems of the first hotel in Niagara Falls. Like, if you remember on leaving day, it was
no hot water.
You could take a shower. And then that
problem.
Was the same weekend Niagara Falls froze up, if you remember.
Oh, yeah, it was cold. I do remember that, yeah.
And so, I mean, that was interesting. The Niagara Falls, the first one was, of course, when Louise Ray came out to promote his book, did the book signing. And so, I mean, that we did there. And then, of course, in 2004, we did one last small event at Healy's. And that tied in with where I was offering tickets for, there was a new show coming out, and it was called Classics Albums Live. And the night before the convention, they did a complete version of Physical Graffiti.
Oh, nice.
So it all tied in a little differently. And that was about eight of them. And I kind of felt at that point, that's enough.
Right. Well, not a bad thing. I mean, not a lot of people could say they promoted one event versus, and you're saying you promoted, you know, eight Led Zeppelin events. That's pretty impressive. I always like to wrap up the podcast and asking some random one-off questions. So I'll ask these to you and you could answer them. Your favorite Led Zeppelin LP?
I tend to like Physical Graffiti because I like the diversity of all the tracks.
Yeah. Favorite Zeppelin song?
I don't really have a favorite. It depends on
always
the mood.
Depends on the hour and the day. Jimmy Page or Robert Plant fan?
I like them both. I just wish Jimmy had done more solo work.
Yeah, I think we all did. Favorite solo project?
That's a tough one. I think Page, I like the Outrider. Plant, I like the 93 tour.
Yeah, Fate of Nations. Yeah, great.
And tour. John Paul Jones, that Zuma tour, I remember being really
heavy. Yeah,
about three times.
Should they have continued after the O2?
You know, the thing about that is the O2, I first of all thought that was Led Zeppelin, a Led Zeppelin show, or the guys in Led Zeppelin trying to put a polished act together. I mean, it's different from the 70s, different type of band. But I mean, if Robert's heart is not in it, then it's hard to really say if that would have been a good reunion. Okay. I mean, you got to give the guy credit for saying, I don't want to do this, and I'm not going to take your money.
Okay. So you're going with a no or a yes?
I think it's more of a no because Robert...
Your first Led Zeppelin-related concert you attended?
Actually, it'll be 40 years ago in about 6 weeks. Robert Plant, Buffalo and Toronto in 83.
Nice. Favorite live Led Zeppelin year?
I'm thinking about my favorite era, 70 to 72.
Very good. Favorite Zepp live show?
Probably pick one from every tour. But the one I think that might be the best show that comes and goes every now and then to me would be the Seattle 72 show.
Yeah, classic. That's a good one. And they do the Black Country Woman. So,
yep, and Dancing Days twice.
Right. I mean, you have to love it. Last Led Zeppelin show you listened to?
Well, I was playing The Song Remains the Same this week, so.
Very good.
And that's 50 years old now.
Well, Grant, I appreciate the time for coming on and catching, getting everybody caught up with what's going on with you and sharing your Zeppelin journey with us, from the fanzines to the conventions and tape trading and all that good stuff in between. Any final thoughts? Anything you want to share with the listeners?
I think we've covered so much. Right. I mean, if you, you know, it's been great talking with you. I mean, there's, and, you know, I guess when you, you know, we'll go over a couple of things when you've actually shut the record button, but
that's when the good conversation comes out. All right. I'm going to leave it on that. Thanks again, Grant, for joining us. You have a great day. Happy 50th anniversary. Songerman's the same. Talk to you soon.
Okay.